This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking to Dr. Rada all about her work as a GP and many of the challenges she faces through this and some of her patients do in accessing support. She's a guest that we've been keen to get on the podcast for some time. As the resident GP on the Sex Education Show, I have been aware of her work for a long time, ever since I watched that, really. She also now co-hosts a Radio 1 show called Life Hacks as their medical expert, which I'd really recommend listening to, also available in podcast form. Before we talk more about the episode and the interview with Dr. Rada, we've got a few stats and a definition. The definition is from the NHS for what it is to be a general practitioner, usually shortened to GP. General practitioners treat all common medical conditions and refer patients to hospital and other medical services for urgent and specialist treatment. They focus on the health of the whole person, combining physical, psychological, and social aspects of care. So I thought that was a really good all-encompassing definition, and one I wanted to include, as I'm aware this role isn't exactly replicated in all the countries that we have listeners. Is there anything else you wanted to say about that, Danielle? No,
it's funny though, because carry on, just ignore that gap.
Go on, I want to hear what's funny now.
No, I was just going to say it's funny because I've never, you know, not I've never, but for a lot of years, you know, growing up when you're younger and you hear GP or go to the doctors and never really thought about what it meant. You know, you think it's just the doctor's a GP. You know, what is a GP? If you ask many young people what a GP is, I mean, talking young people, you know, maybe even children, they wouldn't know, would they? And it's just interesting as well, you know, hearing that definition, what a GP is, you know, that whole, it really is general practice. And it really just start to make you think, you know, having researched some of the work, you know, that GPs do or don't do, especially when it comes to mental health, but so much that's expected from them.
Right, absolutely. And that's one thing that kind of came across in the research as well, is there can be such varying skill sets among general practitioners that whilst it's a role where you should have a bit of knowledge about at least every common condition you're going to come across, there's also a big factor in the background that person's from. And the listeners will hear that a little bit in Dr. Rada's interview as well, that her background and the kind of areas she got placements in through medical school still inform her work now, still inform parts of her approach, certain areas that she's most interested in. And so it's a difficult balance that I don't think you get as much in other areas of the NHS, where you have a clear specialism and so you can be as specialised as you want in that area. Whereas with GPs, it is really helpful to have some specialisms. Like I mentioned my aunt in the episode, she's lucky to have a community psychiatric nurse, a CPN, based at her practice. And so that means for patients that need extra mental health support, there's another person at the practice that they can see in addition to their GP that's right there on site, and that's incredibly helpful.
There's a doctor at my practice who, you know, the receptionist will say, oh, he knows a bit more about mental health, or he's a bit better at, you know, that kind of thing. Like, that's how it's been worded before. But the guy's fully booked. Like, you can't get into it. Do you know what I mean? And so then you think, well, that's who I want to see now, because apparently he's got a bit more experience or vested interest, like you said, and not that the others maybe don't have, but maybe at all, but don't have as much or whatever, but you can't see him. I think that will come out again through the episode and as we talk further in the intro, the demand now that's absolutely, you know, skyrocketed.
Yeah, but I like that you mentioned that phrase, a special interest, because that's often how it's phrased. And that is something the listeners can ask for if you are going to the GP for the first time, or if you're going about your mental health for the first time. You can definitely ask that, is there a GP with a special interest in mental health? Because not only are they potentially going to be extra clued in, But also, I think there can be something to that. If that's their special interest area, they may be able to prioritise giving a longer appointment to that. You know, you can request a double length appointment at the GP. Not a lot of people know that, which I think is partly because of the stretch on resources. It's not really advertised, but you can ask for that. And that's the kind of thing that, if that's a special interest area for one of the practitioners there, then they may be able to prioritise giving you extra support, or may just be equipped with the resources without having to kind of go away and come back to you if it's something more specialist you need help with. Yeah, so that's just me talking, as I think. But to come back to the stats a little bit, because they are relevant, we've talked a little bit about learning, and part of this role, like many in the NHS, is that they have to have continuous learning and development. It's known as CPD, which it stands for Clinical Personal Development. All GPs are required to do a certain number of hours of this type of learning every year to make sure they're constantly improving their practice and keeping up with all the changes and developments in care. And one of the interesting things we found in the research is that there isn't actually any requirement for a certain proportion of this to be linked to mental health.
I was really shocked by that.
Yeah, I think it is quite shocking, because it seems quite a simple thing. You just assume that there's a certain amount of categorising.
Well, absolutely. But also, even before their continued personal development or within medicine, it's clinical personal development, professional development. Even in their training, there's only a small proportion of their whole syllabus, if you like, that's given to mental health. Obviously, it has to be split up. You know, the training that they do covers everything. So there's got to be some kind of breakdown in terms of the modules and the experience and the placements that you do. But the fact that the demand now has increased by, you've got the stat there in front of you, Bobby. Sorry, I'm, you know, in sunny Tenerife while we're Skyping, but you've got the information there from that research, because I'm really, actually, we've enjoyed doing this research, but it has shocked me. But there's been a lot of drivers.
You're exactly right to mention that the increase in demand is really prominent, and that was picked up in the Mind survey of 2018, where they surveyed more than 1,000 GPs who overwhelmingly cited the increase in demand for mental health support in primary care. And in addition to that, as part of the survey, GPs said that 2 in 5, so about 40% of their appointments now involve mental health, whilst 2 in 3 GPs, about 66%, say that the proportion of patients needing help with their mental health has increased even in the last 12 months.
Wow.
So there is that really clear rise in demand. The GPs are seeing it. You know, there's no doubt a lot of changes they're having to make behind the scenes in order to cope with that level of demand. We need the professionals dealing with mental health to keep up with that progression of knowledge and progression of demand.
We're in the middle of a shift, aren't we, between then us becoming more empowered, reducing stigma, increasing knowledge, and then how much of that the GPs are having to then, like you said, they have to deal with. But their pressures, because of the increase in demand, is putting a massive pressure on them and their own mental health, which again is another, you know, a whole new conversation. But what they're dealing with, the amount of paperwork, the amount of hours, the amount of work. I know we had some stats around that, and GPs, and how hard it is for general practitioners and primary care staff to support our communities at the moment with mental health. And because of that, the impact it's having on their own and what support they're getting, if any.
And that's something that Dr. Rada was quite keen to talk about in the episode as well. The importance of NHS professionals being an example, looking after their mental health, doing self-care, taking time off when they need to. You can't preach these things all day long and then not use them yourself. How there can be this pressure to potentially put your own health at risk to support patients. For so many people, their primary reason for getting into this kind of work is to help people. And so it can be easy to prioritise your patient's health to the detriment of your own.
Yeah.
And that's going too far. You know, you absolutely, when you're at work, their health is your priority. but their health shouldn't be to the detriment of yours 24/7. You've got to still have time off and take a break and look after you as well. And I really love that she so articulately talked us through that in the episode.
Yeah, she did.
And you're right about the stretch. You know, none of this war cry we have of how things need to improve and how stigma needs to be defeated. None of this is to say that we don't appreciate the incredible work that GPs do. We understand the challenges. We understand that they're stretched. And we found a lot of stats around that as well. According to NHS England, for example, they are short of around 100,000 staff in the NHS currently, and about 2,500 of those are GPs. That's then expected to rise to over 7,000 by 2023 to 2024. To put that number in perspective, that would be one vacancy for every GP practice forecast to be remaining.
Wow.
So that, you know, that stretch is going to continue unless things change.
Unless things change. And again, it's not just putting quick fixes in place. I mean, we spoke about this and obviously our campaign, talking about promoting mental health in schools and the mandatory education that's surrounding it, because it needs to come, you know, before we get to this point where or young adults, young people, adults in general, older people going in to the GP with their mental health problems. Because, and a lot of GPs and people that I speak to will often say, and even all our guests, Bobby, and you and I, sometimes you just need someone to talk to.
Mm.
Sometimes that's all you need. And when you've got charities that are in place, and it's not, it's just not the first place that you go to. It's still, they're still not, you know, they're stretched as it is. But sometimes it is just the doctor. You feel there's confidentiality. You feel that they might give you some good kind of advice or just an ear. But sometimes before you get to the point, you know, there might not be a necessary, you know, a drug intervention or even maybe major like or long-term therapy. It might just be that you just want your doctor to just have a chat to about how you're feeling at the moment.
Well, I know that's a major driver of yours is prioritising early intervention and prevention. And that's something that we really push, like you say, through mental health education. Because whilst that isn't the solution to shortage of GPs, I think it will help when there are stretches to services. That if you are in a position to better understand your mental health from childhood and potentially see symptoms coming up sooner, rather than, like many people, having to get to a kind of breaking point to realise that you need help, then if you were to go to the GP in a more preemptive time in your mental health journey and then be met with a waiting list, that's not going to be as detrimental as if, as with the current system, yeah, where people aren't educated on this stuff growing up, where the stigma is rife, then you do get to this kind of breaking point, like you say, crisis point, where you can't survive a wait.
Yeah, so, where you can't wait, yeah.
Yeah, so whilst this doesn't fix the shortage of GPs, there are rightly several angles to come at this, where we can make improvements on all sides to better outcomes. Yeah.
And because ultimately it's helping yourself, isn't it? Like, we understand that there are clinical diagnoses everywhere and that there's some mental illnesses that are there and that we're dealing with and we can't cope with and we're struggling with and we need intervention. But there's also a high, high proportion of people who are struggling that probably could be avoided and could be almost managed and helped themselves. And Dr. Rada speaks about that a lot as well. But without that awareness, is exactly what you've just said, understanding early kind of thoughts about what might be my triggers, what have I maybe experienced in my life as a young person or growing up that may now have an impact on how I might be living or behaving or, you know, feeling, what are those things that maybe, you know, and just being able to talk and reflect and listen to yourself and know yourself, understand your thoughts, all of those things that, you know, again, Dr. Rada talks about, and she says to, I keep saying Dr. Rada, but she kept telling us often, she said, you can call me Rada, fine, you don't need to keep calling me Dr. Rada. But, you know, that absolutely would help.
Right, for sure. And I'm really glad that we covered a lot of that in the interview. Another thing that Dr. Rada talked about, which we haven't really addressed in as cohesive a way as she has, is the difference between superficial and deep stigma. So this concept of separate types of stigma, like levels almost, is something that she really works to inform people on. And I think that's really important. So I'll leave it to her to talk through that a little bit more in the episode, but I thought that was a really important conversation. So all in all, we were so delighted to interview her. She's so sweet.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
For yeah. all her success and work in the media and in the public eye, she's remained incredibly down to earth. And I'm sure that benefits her patients so much, as well as her more general public facing destigmatizing work. So she was a really incredible first ever GP for us to interview. It's taken a little while because we wanted to get that so right. So I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. Is there anything else you wanted to mention, Danielle?
No, just absolutely echo everything that you said. She's absolutely amazing. I thought she was just so happy and approachable and gorgeous, and I loved her. And she loved the fact that we were doing our live show, and she was like, yeah, let me know, and if I'm free, I'll come down. And I'm like, yeah, we had a great chat with her. She spent a while with us, didn't she, in the studio, and it was just really nice to be around her. She was really enlightening and really, really positive. Her whole vibe was just great, a really, really great guest.
Absolutely. So we'll get into the interview with Dr. Rada in a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. I'm a strong believer that learning changes lives. That's why I'm delighted to be partnering with The Great Courses Plus. With their streaming service, you can learn about virtually any topic, not just the basics, but in depth with the help of engaging experts. So how does this work? Well, through The Great Courses Plus website or their handy app, you get unlimited access to thousands of courses in video or audio formats. For example, I'm currently working through the course Building Your Resilience, Finding Meaning in Adversity. We've talked a lot about resilience here on the pod, including in one of our most moving episodes, which was on that theme. However, Molly Burcombe, who hosts these classes, goes into even more depth, covering so many ways to build resilience, including self-care, stress management, mindfulness, and CBT techniques, just to list a few off the top of my head. I'd really recommend joining me in taking this course or any other that piques your interest with The Great Courses Plus. And my favourite part, you can download classes to take on the go or even change playback speed, just like with podcasts. So I'm pleased to share a special offer for our listeners, which is 50% off if you sign up for a 3-month plan. You just have to use our link, thegreatcoursesplus.com/health. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/health. You can also find that link in the episode description. Do let us know how you get on.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rada. I'm a GP and a broadcaster. So I've got a particular interest in emotional and mental well-being, and that probably started when I was at school. So my parents and teachers always remarked that I was quite a sensitive child. I was a bit of a worrier and I'd get kind of quite anxious at school. So I think it probably started from there in terms of me being aware about what that meant. And I think sometimes that term is used in quite a negative or derogatory way. Mm-hmm. But what I started to realise as I got older is that actually it also has its benefits. So it has its benefits in terms of being more empathetic with other people, being able to understand other people, and also being open to understanding what they might be feeling. So for me, I probably got an interest in emotional well-being from that point and tried to learn strategies for myself during that time, which would help me reduce my worrying and reduce my anxiety at school and growing up. Also, my parents were educational psychologists. They used to lecture in psychology. So, oh, wow. So maybe I picked up a bit of interest from them in terms of behaviour and how things work. But I think also I've got quite a curious mind, so I like understanding, and I love people, so I like communicating with people and understanding their stories. So on that basis, I was always the person at school who people would come to for advice, or right. If there was someone having a problem, I would try and be that ever-present fixer, which which later on I realised wasn't always the right solution. But I think I always felt like I didn't want people to be on their own with their problems or their worries. So
that's really nice. Yeah, I was kind of similar. I was often the person that people asked for advice. I'm still generally the main person friends ask for relationship advice as well, which I find odd when I've been single for most of my adult life. But I don't know. I think sometimes it's more down to your approach at times than necessarily your experience.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think probably people pick up on the ability that you have to listen and to hear what they've got to say. Because again, a lot of the time, you know, these days especially, you're looking at people out in a restaurant or two friends out and they're both on their mobile phones, or one person's talking and the other one's not really listening. So I think if you're a good listener and you show interest in what someone's got to say, then I think people will tend to come to you for advice, even if you don't necessarily have any expertise in it, because they just feel heard. And I think feeling heard is one of the main drivers to all of us feeling kind of connected and feeling safe as well.
So. Yeah, and understood. And we'll come back to that because I'm sure that informs your work now. But if we just stay in your background for a moment, were you as a child aware of the worrying and the anxiety being more so than what other kids experienced, or was it just normal and all you knew?
I think that was all I really knew. So I've got two sisters and a brother. They were both all older than me, so I was the youngest one. So maybe it was slightly kind of disguised in the fact that I was the youngest, so I'd always kind of go to them for help, or if I'd left my spelling book at home and I was a bit anxious, I'd kind of go and find my elder sister in her classroom. So maybe it wasn't particularly obvious. I think it was just something that I thought was just how things were. And I mean, it didn't particularly hold me back, but I think it made me much more aware of when other people are having sort of challenging feelings. And I think it really drove my sense of empathy and feeling like I wanted to help people. So that was kind of my school times. I love people. I love teamwork. I was really interested in science. I was quite curious. So I sort of thought, well, medicine's probably the right option for me because that combines all of those things together.
Right.
And so went to study at university, and again kind of came across more kind of mental health in that I went to Cambridge for my first 3 years and then London for my last three. And while I was in Cambridge particularly, there were quite a few people in my year group who unfortunately were admitted to hospital, who became very unwell mentally. And so I observed that in quite an extreme form in some cases. The whole kind of perspective of work pressures, academic pressures, quite intense environments. I think I started to then relook at the world and actually think, well, you know, what is important, and really that your well-being is by far the most important thing. So that was an interesting experience as well, to see that in that environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And while you were saying that, I was thinking about that may surprise some listeners to hear about that, particularly in an institution like Cambridge, because there is this perception of everyone being so high-powered there and sort of so together in order to be performing at that academic level. What you don't think of is that, well, A, mental illness can affect anybody, but also B, part of the performance in those environments is because of the pressure.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it's a very, I mean, I think any university is very intense, especially at universities is difficult because it's the first time you're going away from home to a new place, you've got to try and make new friends, you've got, you know, you're in charge of your money for the first time. So lots of unique pressures about going to university. But yeah, certainly for me, you know, growing up with kind of parents who were very academic, it was the sort of first time I thought, gosh, actually, there are other things in life. And that message of achieving is not be all and end all, by far more important is your health. And I think, you know, in some of those environments which are very pressurised, if you don't have the right support or you don't have the right strategies or something else happens in life which you can't prevent, then, you know, that's when things become difficult. So it was sort of a time when a particular person that I knew became very unwell, and everyone kind of turned to me, even though I wasn't actually clinically trained at that point, in order to contact someone to get them assessed, you know, by a doctor. So again, it was kind of almost that responsibility, if you like, of sort of trying to help someone else be assessed and, you know, be looked after. So
that's fascinating that even at that stage you were fitting into the caring role.
Yes.
That's really interesting, because my parents sometimes tease me about that. I don't drink, but I have been responsible for a lot of drunk friends over the years. And normally I would stay well aware if anyone's like getting sick or if anyone's falling over. I'm like, I'm not involved in this. And actually that would make me feel quite nauseous.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's one of my friends, I like just snap into this like protective mode.
Yeah.
And they tease me that it's like the doctor gene that I've inherited.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's interesting, isn't it? And I think, and again, I mean, that's a lovely characteristic to have. You also have to be quite careful of your own well-being, don't you? And that you're not kind of giving too much, and you sort of keep something for yourself, and that you look after yourself as well, because there's a kind of fine balance between the two. So
right, absolutely. Yeah. And so at that point, was it something you could handle, that kind of level of responsibility and supporting others?
I mean, it was definitely something that was quite a surprise to me that my group of friends were sort of looking to me.
Right.
I think I just kind of took that on board and again, just contacted her mum, actually. But obviously now there's probably a lot more support services than were back then in terms of mental health and student support services. But it was, you know, at that age, it was quite frightening. But, it, you know, she was admitted and she kind of went into recovery quite well. But it was a whole new, it really opened up my eyes to sort of what was important in life, in terms of we can't always prevent things, but what can we do to try to keep ourselves healthy, and how can we help each other to do that as well? So,
and I think that can often happen. You can get so caught up in work and study and life, and then it gets to a point where your health is bad.
Yes.
And suddenly there's no other priority.
Yes, yes, exactly. I think that's a very famous quote from the Dalai Lama, which is in my gym, which is a very long quote, but it's basically something like, you know, I don't understand humanity in terms of they work to get money, and then they spend money to get their health back. It's kind of like a circular thing where he's basically saying, yeah, in terms of our priorities and what we do to stay healthy, we actually destroy our health sometimes by all these things that we feel we should be doing. So it's, go and look it up. I can't, it's a very long quote, but it's a good one. It's a good one.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, the gist of that sounds really good.
Yeah. So after that, then kind of moved to London to do my clinical training. And again, kind of then did more of the clinical stuff. So kind of got my first exposure into mental health and clinical work, and then went into hospital medicine. So I did that for about 6-7 years, and then moved into general practice. And I think, again, even in hospital medicine, you know, working some jobs which were quite challenging, like A&E, for example, where, you know, sort of healthcare professionals are working really, really hard, mm-hmm. but also seeing sometimes the fallout from that in terms of their mental health, so colleagues' mental health, or the ability to sort of debrief after you've seen something quite traumatic, or the first time you see someone, you know, who's passed away, for example, as a doctor. So those kind of experiences, at the time, I didn't really realise that obviously they have huge impacts. But I think, you know, looking back on them now, when you think about the sort of life of any healthcare professional in terms of what they see, just emphasizing that huge importance of debriefing and having that kind of support around you is really important.
For sure. And I think it's easy to be caught up in how much work there is to do.
Yes.
Yes. And if you're the junior doctor on a placement with all these senior doctors that have been doing it for years, I think there can be that sort of unspoken pressure to just get on with it.
Yes, yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. And I think it's much better now, actually. But I think there is sort of that idea that, and in realistic terms, you know, you do just kind of have to get on with it and get all your sort of jobs done. But then when you come out of your shift, you do feel things. And because you're so intimately involved in people's stories, not just their medical conditions or what you've seen, but also that person and who they are and their family and what's happened to them, and you see some pretty big life events, you know, mm-hmm. or people within huge life events, so it's a tough job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a really important point. We had a guest on previously called Jenny Pusey, who's currently a medical student,
mm-hmm.
and she shared her experience of seeing someone die for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And she's at university in Edinburgh, and she went to the counselling service at the university. And on paper, it sounds really wonderful that they've got those services there.
Mm-hmm.
But what she actually found was they weren't prepared for that type of support. You know, used to grief in terms of, like, relatives of students.
Yes.
Because they're the counselling service for the whole uni.
I see.
In terms of what the medical students were going through.
Yes.
It's such a specific lifestyle in a way. It can just take over.
Yes, yes.
Your whole well-being, depending how a shift goes.
That's true. And not just what happens during the shift, but obviously in terms of hours spent in your job as well. So sometimes what you'll find is that, you know, the busier people get, then they'll start dropping their hobbies and they won't be able to sort of see friends, mm-hmm. and so or go home necessarily because it's quite busy. So again, it's that whole sort of the personal side of that person's life.
Yeah.
And then that can then obviously you don't have any outlet for that sort of stress that you see at work. So kind of it's important to try to kind of keep those going, and or at least try to recognise the signs of when things are getting a bit too much.
Absolutely. You can fall into the trap of being hypocritical and encouraging the patients to look after themselves. Yes, and then you're not doing anything.
Yes, I think that's very true, isn't it? I think a lot of the time we sort of say that people in whichever job, they're probably, you know, whatever they're doing, they're not actually doing it themselves very well. So, if you're in a job where you're trying to look after people, then, you know, ideally it should be that those people have got enough to give themselves and have got those sort of strategies for themselves, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And was that something you were quite aware of at that stage, or is it something you've had to learn?
I think it's something that I've had to learn, actually. I think at the time I just was, obviously, you say you're so busy, you just kind of get on with things, and it's almost just taken as read that that's how it is. So mm-hmm. I just kind of got on with it. But I think as I've kind of got a bit older, and also I teach medical students sometimes, and I also do some work with other GPs, you start to then realise actually all of these things looking back. You know, one of my real passions is to help them empower themselves to stop, take a step back and reflect on what's happening in their life, and to work out what can they control and what can't they control, and then what can they change within their control environment to actually make their lives better and to make themselves happier. Because we all need to be happy and feel well in order to do our job well. So it's all part of the same thing. It's not really separate.
Right, for sure. Because there's not going to be that day when suddenly a role in the NHS is easy.
So yes, exactly.
You can't change that, but yes, there's a lot you can do in terms of self-care.
Exactly.
To make sure you're at least prepared for those difficult days.
Exactly. It's like kind of having that reserve tank, isn't it? That, you know, if your reserve tank is so low, then you're not going to be able to deal with things when they're stressful. But if you try to keep that as high as possible, then actually if something stressful's there, then hopefully you'll have more reserve to sort of more of a buffer to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also in terms of, you know, longevity in that job, you know, in terms of keeping people in that job, that's really important. And not just about self-care, but I think actually when people feel they can make positive changes for themselves and make a difference, that then empowers them.
Right.
And once people realise that they are in control of something and that whatever happens, they can do something that's in their interest, then that also has a beneficial effect on their mental health. So it's not even just a self-care strategy, it's actually recognising that those have worked and that they're things they can always rely on themselves to do. And that gives them a sense of, okay, you know, whatever happens, I'm going to be all right because I know that I can do something to help myself. And I think that's really important, that sense of empowerment, but also autonomy that is within them and that can't be taken away from them.
I love that. You must be such a positive force in your practice.
I hope so. I'm not always in general life, because obviously we all go through challenges. But I think for me, that idea of choice is so important. I think when people feel they haven't got a choice, or they feel hemmed in or blocked in, whatever that's related to, that's when people start to feel hopeless and then things get worse. So I think even those simple choices in that moment of, I'm feeling like this, okay, I could either do this or I could do that. Where are those options going to take me? And which one do I want to take? Even like if you're feeling rubbish, just standing up and going out for a walk will take you down that path of feeling better, as opposed to sitting there and worrying or thinking about something. So I think it's those simple choices added up.
Yeah.
And what they can do to kind of push you down the journey you want to be in.
Absolutely. I love that. And it's very universal, not only for you and your colleagues, because there is a shortage of GPs. And so these kind of messages are so important, because you'd much rather a colleague, for example, goes part-time and mm-hmm. makes a choice like that mm-hmm. than they quit and get burnt out in the profession.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, you know, for everyone really, it's that thing where obviously sometimes, unfortunately, you know, our mental health is so low or so challenging that we can't, you know, we can't make those choices that we want to make. And then we need that support. We need that help from other people or from other types of therapy. But more generally, I think it's about caring enough about yourself to try and make those small decisions that will add up to getting you further down the path of sort of feeling better.
I love that. That's really universal as well. I'm sure a lot of your patients have that experience where they can have issues around their mental health. Those issues can hold them back from making certain life changes. And because of that, it just exacerbates the mental illness.
Yes, absolutely. And again, it's about recognising, obviously, sometimes, you know, we're not in a place where we can make those choices because things are so difficult. But it's about, you know, hopefully helping people with support, with therapy, with medication, with whichever kind of input you like to get them up to that point where they can start then, you know, making the decisions they want to make and making the choices that are going to help them, but that they know that they can do something to help themselves and that something works, because sometimes obviously things can feel so low and so dark that, you know, you start to doubt if things will get better. But just knowing that something, even a small thing, has helped, I think is reassuring to remember.
And that's something I think is so brilliant about general practice. Even in the way you're talking about this, it's so clear how you take into account the whole person, that it's not one specific area of the body or one specific illness even at times, but it's how can I support the wellness of this whole life?
Yes, and the people around them, because obviously, you know, family, friends, all the people around them are going to be crucial in that person's recovery. So what's going on with those people? You know, what do they think about it? Do they understand what's happening? Are they helping or hindering? You know, are things kind of, what else could that person do to draw as much support from the people around them to help them? And other things like, you know, like job pressures, for example, they might be under, or housing pressures, all of those things, financial pressures, which make obviously mental health a lot worse. So it's about looking at all of those things really, but also on the other hand, not overwhelming someone with all of that information in one go, I think.
Yes, that must be such a difficult balance, particularly in the strict time limits you have with each patient.
Yeah, it is a challenge. But again, it's something which needs to be done. And if it takes time, it just takes time. And again, you know, with general practice, you have obviously the luxury and the sort of fortunate thing that you obviously can bring people back and you have that really ongoing relationship with them. And there are so many other brilliant organisations as well, you know, local charities and, you know, signposting to different places with information, for example. It's not just looking at those things, it's things like exercise, you know, being out in nature, you know, connecting with people, sleep. I always think there's a kind of triangle pyramid and of well-being, and we're focusing a lot on the top of that pyramid, but what we need to remember is the foundation of that, which is, you know, sleep, what we're eating, our, you know, our social lives, you know, nature. They're not forgetting those basic things which are so important for our well-being.
And that's something that you've described can just as easily affect medical professionals, that they also can be so guilty of missing these things.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But I love that about general practice, that there's that kind of embedding in the community that you've talked about, the ongoing relationships, the understanding of local pressures like housing and how that's going to affect people. What sort of things do you find can hold people back from coming to their GP?
Although it's got better, I still think there's a lot of stigma around mental health. I think perhaps we've reduced the sort of the stigma at a superficial level, but I think there's a lot of deeper stigma around, for example, particularly something that I'm interested in is sort of children's and young people's mental health. And I think there's still something out there amongst the adult population where we don't really want to accept or look at or believe that children can have mental health conditions or problems. I think adults tend to want to think children are happy and they're having a lovely childhood, which obviously, hopefully, you know, a lot of children are. But I think we need to accept that actually, you know, mental health conditions or difficulties can often start very early in childhood. I think there's still a big stigma around that. And that's kind of what one of the things that I want to try and do a bit more of in terms of just talking about that and making sure that it's not, the stigma's not being addressed at a superficial level, but we're actually seeing what's going on in childhood.
I think it's a really understandable view that nobody wants to think about children struggling with their mental health.
No.
And we don't like the fact that it can affect people from so young.
Mm-hmm.
But the alternative approach is we just cross our fingers and hope the kids are okay.
Exactly.
And that approach doesn't work. So
yeah.
We need to have these difficult conversations, confront how difficult it can be for so many kids.
Yeah, and I think probably we do that because perhaps we think that if we accept that, then adults will be blamed, is that it's your fault, you know, but it, obviously it's not.
Or it almost makes it more real to acknowledge it.
Exactly, and it's no one's fault. Sometimes these things just happen, you know, or just occur. So I think getting rid of that kind of blaming culture that we tend to do is really important. But also, you know, there's been a lot of research, particularly in America, around ACEs, kind of adverse childhood experiences, and looking at traumatic events in a child's life. And looking to see if you have so many of these ACEs happening, that actually it doesn't just affect your mental health long term, but also affects your physical health long term. The kind of conversation around childhood trauma is really important to see, because I think their statistics are that probably, I can't remember what they are, but a high proportion of children have at least one of these ACEs in their childhood. So it's, and then like you say, then unless we address that, then those children then grow up into young adults. They don't necessarily have the strategies to deal with what they've been through, and then they obviously become adults. So it's something long-term that we have to look at, I think.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up that approach of highlighting ACEs, because it's a really nice, proactive way of examining risk factors for children,
yes.
Which again is something that can be uncomfortable to do. And I'm sure it's not easy to bring up with your patients concerns around their children.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
It is so important. And even if there's not existing issues, even if there's not any mental illness that's been caused by these problems,
mm-hmm.
The preemptiveness and the checking in is so vital.
Exactly, yeah. And that's something that I'm all about, is, you know, prevention and promotion and you know, trying to enable people to find their strategies
mm-hmm.
to keep well before people become unwell. We tend to focus a lot on what happens when someone becomes unwell, but we need to focus more in and put more resources on prevention. And those strategies will be different for everybody, you know, and they'll be different for the same person on different days or different hours of that day. So, you know, in one moment, listening to some music or a song that makes you cry and gets all your emotions out will be good for you, might be your strategy. Another moment will be just going to cinema and distracting yourself, or, you know, so I think it's about working out what are your strategies as an individual, what works for you, and just trying them out at different times, because sometimes we need strategies that where we are addressing our feelings and we're focusing on them, and other times we need distraction or we need to be taken away from that. So it's, sometimes we need to go for a good run, or we need to kind of just have a break and put our phones down. But it's about just working out what that is for you. And I think once you start to learn that about yourself, again, you then get that empowerment and that feeling of, okay, I can do this.
Yeah, and it can be an immense feeling of pride to take ownership of your health and see those results.
Exactly.
And I think there's pluses and minuses there. That's one of the complicated things about mental health we often talk about on the podcast, that there can be such a pressure on the people experiencing it to take a certain amount of ownership, do a certain amount of research. And at times that can be that there needs to be more resources out there. There
yeah.
are gaps.
Yeah.
But equally, a certain amount of that is necessary.
Yeah.
That I often say, no doctor is going to be as clued in minute to minute on how you feel as you are.
Absolutely. You're right, because you're the one living that experience, and only you know. And only you know what's right for you in that moment and what's going to help you in that moment. And again, also recognising that we're not always able to make those right kind of choices for ourselves, and sometimes we're just exhausted, or sometimes we can't do it, and that's okay too, you know. Sometimes you just need to be in that kind of in that state where you're just being rather than doing,
right.
You know, we don't always need to take away challenging feelings. You know, that's another message that I think is really important to get out there, is that every feeling is valid and every feeling is there and can be felt and should be felt. And, you know, I think we often talk like I was saying, I'm a sensitive child, you know, it's that idea, well, you shouldn't be unhappy, you shouldn't be sad, right. You should always be happy.
Yeah,
you
know,
you
should always good and bad emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I did a CBeebies series almost 2 years ago now, which was called Feeling Better, which is all about emotions for under fives. And I lived in a little house with two puppets who were amazing. And we did a feeling every episode. So one was feeling angry, feeling sad. And and that was very much the message, was that every feeling is there and there aren't good or bad feelings. They're just feelings. And to learn to how to recognise those and to ask someone, you know, for help if you need it. But there are different ways of getting those feelings out. But I think this idea around we should always be happy is a really dangerous message, because we're human and we can't always be happy.
And in fact, as I've said before, someone that's constantly happy, that can actually be a sign of mental illness, that is not normal for people.
No, it's not. It's not. And I think there is a huge, but that there's a huge pressure for everyone to be, you know, to show this side of them as, you know, a classic thing on Instagram or social media, isn't it? Oh, I'm everything's wonderful and everything's fine and I'm happy and I'm successful and I've got this and I've got that. And actually, you know, that's just an impossible pressure and it's not a realistic state of affairs anyway.
No, and it's not even necessarily aspirational.
No.
Because for a lot of people to be happy all the time, it might mean that they're constantly on holiday.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's
it might be that they're constantly playing their favourite sport, or like, and unless that sport is your job.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, that's not a sustainable lifestyle.
Exactly. And also, you know, through challenging feelings, we learn a lot as well. So, you know, we learn a lot about empathy. We learn about how strong we are. We learn how to listen to other people. You know, we grow as people. So again, sometimes, you know, challenging feelings can have their own purpose and they can have their own sort of a positive outcome. So, you know, just to kind of deny them or push them down actually creates more trouble, I think, in the future in terms of mental health.
Mm-hmm, for sure. I wanted to come back a little bit to what you mentioned about your CBeebies series, because we lead the campaign for mental health education in schools across the UK.
Yes, I saw that.
And within that, there can be concerns raised at times about, is it too young for certain kids to know about mental illness?
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, I remember before when sex ed was coming through,
yes,
and was being made compulsory for the first time, and there were a lot of similar concerns, yes, of like, kids shouldn't know about this,
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
But we've since moved on and learned that this information is to help protect them and keep them safe.
Yes.
Have you had anything similar where people have responded badly to you doing mental health related programming, mm-hmm, to kids, mm-hmm, of such a young age?
Yes. I know, it's interesting you brought that up, because I was going to relate that as well back to sex education, because I did a programme on Channel 4 about sex education, and I got some comments around that, to the same kind of attitude of, right, oh, you're encouraging children. And so again, when I've been interviewed sort of after programmes or after some broadcasting I've done around mental health, I have had, you know, some listeners, you know, phoning in saying, you know, this is ridiculous, or this is too early, or, you know, the snowflake generation, and those kind of comments.
was Piers one of the people that
told you? No, not yet. To me, it's never too young to learn about mental health, because again, right from day one, you have mental well-being, you have an emotional state, you have mental health from the day you're born, even if you're not consciously aware of it, or you can't express it. And so for me, it's a basic life skill, just like how to feed yourself, how to wash yourself, how to look after yourself, is how to learn to walk. To me, it's everything, and it's a basic life skill that we all need to know, because we all experience it. And if we don't teach it, or we don't emphasize how important mental well-being is, then your children get the wrong messages. They have feelings and they don't understand them, and they get worried by them, and they get frightened by them, and then they internalize that. And then later on, or years to come, it will come out in a way that's distressing for them, and it will be, you know, potentially a mental health diagnosis. So to me, it's never too early.
Right. And that's, I think, a very real danger you've described there, the having feelings about feelings.
Yes.
Because that can become very habitual and,
exactly,
can really exacerbate your emotions.
Exactly. And also that understanding that thoughts come and go. you know, and that sometimes we don't understand why thoughts pop up in our heads, but it doesn't mean that we necessarily, you know, they kind of pass in and out just like feelings do. If you don't tell a child that or let them understand that in terms of mindfulness or meditation, or then that child's going to think, oh, why did I think that thought, and does that make me a bad person, or and then kind of feel guilty about it, or same with feelings. So I think, again, just that basic understanding, which is really basic but really vital, is important, because otherwise they will internalize it. They'll feel ashamed to say it to an adult because no one else is saying it to them, so they think they're the only one who's experiencing it.
Right.
And then it all, and then shame obviously leads to huge amounts of issues for all of us later on.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, that if the kids aren't taught that somewhere, there won't be any change to how mental illness is viewed. And I particularly like the idea of that show and having kids be taught that there aren't bad emotions, because otherwise, I'm sure for a lot of their parents, they've grown up without that. And so their kids grow up seeing their parents pushing down emotions,
yes,
or trying to hide certain emotions and trying to pretend other ones.
Yes.
And that can be incredibly confusing.
Absolutely. And we also, you know, we also did a song every episode. So the songs are really fun. It's done in a really fun and a really engaging way. And again, it's just about, like you say, just getting children used to the idea of feelings and what they are. And you know, it's done in such a sort of bright, fun way that actually, you know, it's like I say, it's kind of like a life skill, really.
Yeah, well, it's incredibly normalising. And that can be brilliant, even if you have never experienced mental illness.
Yes.
But equally, I think it can have such profound impact if you do.
Exactly.
Like, we've talked quite a few times on the podcast about OCD.
Mm-hmm.
And I think nearly every guest has mentioned questioning constantly whether or not they were a bad person because of some of these intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
Because they'd never learned that we all have negative thoughts.
Yes.
So when their negative thoughts started piling up in a more intense way than they were used to, they instantly equated that as something to do with them, some personal fault.
Exactly. And then that gives them the idea there's something wrong with them, and then they feel ashamed, and then it all just gets worse and worse and worse, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of that. So, and again, you know, even if you're never going to experience some of those, you know, challenging feelings, it's all about empathy. It's about understanding other people when they do. And again, empathy builds society, builds connection, builds community. And so those kind of that empathy and that kindness towards others is just so important for all of us. It's not just the individual.
Mm. Absolutely. I love that. And so we are running out of time, unfortunately. But I just wanted to finish off by asking you, if people are listening to this and they're considering going to the GP and they're maybe nervous or have any kind of concerns about that, what would you say to them?
So I would say that in an average day, I probably see at least two patients who are coming in about their mental health, if not more. So it's something that we see a lot of, that is nothing to be ashamed of, because all of us have difficult feelings or challenging life experiences, and we're all in it together. And so I'd say that if you are nervous, then it's okay to feel nervous, but maybe bring someone with you, a friend or family member, maybe write down some things you want to say in case you forget them or if you feel nervous. And, you know, if you feel, again, that you're not being listened to or not being heard, then obviously, you know, there try another doctor, go back. There are other organisations which are fantastic, like Mind and Samaritans. So many people, so many support services out there that can help. So, yeah, just ask someone for some support if you're feeling nervous.
And I would also add to that, that if you have gone to GP before, you should always feel able to go back.
Yes, 100%.
I know from my aunt who is a GP as well, one of her biggest frustrations is when people take medical decisions without speaking to their GP.
Mm-hmm.
So if you feel ready and able to come off medication, or if you're having side effects and you want to talk to someone, or you've been on the waiting list for counselling for a while and you're really struggling, there's always that option to go back to the GP, that they're not going to be bothered by you needing more support. That's what they're there for.
Absolutely. And like I say, I say this to my mum, because she's the worst person for going to the GP about anything, because she's too polite. She says, oh, I don't want to bother them. And I say, you know, you know, it's when you don't bother people that you get unstuck. So it's, you need to bother people, and it's not even bothering. It's just what they're there to do and what their job is. So, you know, don't sit in silence, don't wait, don't delay, because, you know, just as with physical health, mental health will get worse if it's not addressed early. So, you know, look after yourself and make sure you're going. And like I say, if you're having difficulty, go with someone else. I see plenty of patients who bring someone with them if they're worried or nervous. So, yeah.
Right. Well, even in the most oversimplified sense, the GPs aren't achieving anything if they've got an empty surgery.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's what they're there for. You know, sometimes a patient comes and says, oh, I'm so sorry to bother you. And I say, that's why I'm here. That's my job.
I came to work to see you.
Exactly.
Grand. So we'll finish up there then. If people want to find you online, where should they go?
Yeah, so I'm just on Twitter at Dr. Rada Modgill and Instagram as well at Dr. Rada. So, yeah.
And you've got a website?
Yes, I do. It's drrada.co.uk.
Do you want me to double check that?
Yes, please, because I've forgotten it.
Do you want to say it again?
Okay. Yeah, it's drrada.co.uk.
Great. And I'll put a link to that in the episode description as well.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.